When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Hi guys, I'm joining you on the final day of July. It went by fast, didn't it? And we're going to do something very special today. I have a special reporter's notebook ready for you. A reporter's notebook is one of my favorite segments that I'm able to share here on Smarter News, where it's a little bit of a behind the scenes into reporting on a certain topic. So for example, last year I was in Normandy. I put together a few different reports for you and interviews while I was there. And then I did a reporter's notebook, which was more of a personal reflection. You know, here are some of the challenges that I faced while reporting in this area. Here are some of the observations of what it was like to report here. Here's some of how I felt about this. So it's a little bit of a peek behind the scenes. This is going to be a different type of reporter's notebook because I'm not on scene, which is part of the problem. And I think part of why this particular reporter's notebook is important now is that the challenges in reporting the story that I'm about to share with you are so important to how we're all feeling about it when we see it. And that is the story of what's happening between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, the war that continues there. We're coming to a two-year anniversary of that conflict. And there's now a momentum of questions about what's happening on the ground. There's great criticism of Israel at this time. There's great concern about aid and about the Palestinians that are in Gaza. And there's a big question about what's next. But in all of this is also a really important question about journalism. And it's affecting how we're experiencing this story. So this is a reporter's notebook where I want to share with you some of what I'm seeing as a major challenge to reporting this to you, and also how that's affecting our experience collectively. We also have a very interesting news headline, which is the New York Times had to issue a clarification. I wouldn't say it's a correction. When I read it to you, you'll see what I mean. It's not exactly a correction. It's a clarification of an image that was on the front page of their newspaper last week and also was shared all around the world. And this clarification highlights, again, some of the challenges related to this story. So let's sort of take a big step back. I always like to do this and think about, you know, why is this story important? Why does this story matter? And we can get real basic. There's all sorts of reasons why this story matters. But oftentimes, as you peel away all the different pieces of the story, you get to something super, super basic. These are very common themes for us in humanity. You know, people fall in love, they get in fights, there's crime, there's triumph. You know, we can really, really pare it down to something very basic. And this story matters because war is bad, because we don't want to see people at war. War begets more war. Conflict has a way of expanding. Conflict is not good for anybody that's involved, even those that are later called the victors. War is not good. It's not good for us. There was a famous phrase, you know, war is not good for children and other living things. You know, war is bad. So this is why this story matters. The who, what, where, when, how, and why in this story can actually be debated at a level that's not typical of other stories. When things get real chaotic, I often go down to the very basics, which is, you know, again, a very traditional model. We all learned it in elementary school when it comes to journalism. Who, what, where, when, how, and why? In this particular story, though, even trying to answer some of those questions can be complicated. I can talk to you about how this latest chapter of this conflict was born after the terrorist attacks of October 7th. But there are those that will argue, well, the The roots of this conflict go back decades, or maybe even thousands of years. So even some of the basics of this story can be heavily debated. And then you have another layer to all of this, which is we're talking about a part of the world where, despite the amazing access that technology gives us, we have very little direct access on the ground, meaning that yes, there are journalists that are working in Israel, but there are very few independent journalists, if any, that are working inside Gaza. And we're going to talk a little bit about the reason why for that. So we've become overly reliant on these viral images and videos because we don't have a lot of access from people that we can determine, well, this is a trustworthy person, or this is a person that maybe has a certain point of view, but they're on the ground there and they're able to share with us something that we otherwise would not see. We're overly reliant on these social media posts and videos that we can't even track, that oftentimes we can't verify, that are saying they're one thing, but we don't really know for sure. Sometimes we don't even know what exact day these events happen or even what year, and it can be very confusing. So we have an entire body of media, including myself in all of this, who doesn't have any context for what's actually happening on the ground, no really solid resources, trustworthy resources, and who have never actually been to that part of the world. I have been to Israel. I have been to the West Bank. I have not been in Gaza. And there's a reason for that. Gaza is run by Hamas, a terrorist group. It's a different situation on the ground there than in the West Bank. So I have no context. You know, I can look at a map and we can try to talk to you about north, south, east, and west. We could try to do all of that. But I want you to really think about the entire body, most of the majority of the American media and the global media not having any experience about where they're doing a lot of reporting right now. And that needs to be underscored. So we're relying on these images. We're relying on some of the very little photographs and video that we're getting out of Gaza, and we can't verify it. So that's really important to understand when we're taking a look at what happened with the New York Times. Because if we're just all really dependent on just a little bit of information that we're getting out of Gaza, then these images and these videos get a disproportionate amount of attention. And when the New York Times puts their name behind it, because the New York Times was able to have a photographer go in and take some photos and take some videos and is able to get some of those images out, they are setting a very important piece of information out into the world and also setting the tone for a narrative about a story. So the story is, let me show you this. This is again from last week. But this is also during a time when there's increasing attention about what's happening at Gaza. There's more and more reports about famine and starvation for Palestinians on the ground. There's more criticism of Israel and whether or not aid is getting into Gaza and America and our role as partners of Israel and what that looks like and where the UN is and what about food distribution aid centers and all these different things. There's been sort of this momentum growing about this question. And then you have this picture from the New York Times. And what you're seeing on your screen here, for those of you listening on podcasts, is now a very famous picture of a woman who's cradling a child that is emaciated and looks incredibly sick. And the title for this article, if we can move in a little bit more so you can see it, shows us a certain perspective on this story that absolutely deserves to be covered. And it says this, young, old, and sick, starve to death in Gaza. There is nothing, is the quote. And the caption underneath this photograph, underneath that headline of the article, is the name of the child who's about 18 months old with his mother, who said he was born healthy, but was recently diagnosed with severe malnutrition. A doctor said the number of children dying of malnutrition in Gaza has risen sharply. So a few questions right away with that caption, you know, which doctor said this? Well, we're talking about a number of children dying, how many? We don't want to see any child hurt or injured or dying of malnutrition anywhere in the world. So the specifics here really matter. And the article goes on to describe the challenges of aid and the challenges of finding food and how families are struggling. Now, if you listen to our Scoop broadcast on Monday, this is our foundational podcast that we do once a week here at Smarter News. I mentioned this photograph because there were already questions that were brewing about it. But the only person that I saw that put a detailed report on the photograph was an independent journalist that was reshared by Israel's government. And because it is a government of a nation state, I felt it was important to mention to you, but I didn't know a lot about this independent journalist. And therefore, I had to add that caveat. I can't verify what this independent journalist is saying. I don't have those resources, but this is shared by the Israeli government defending itself because Israel has said aid is not a problem. Aid is flowing to Gaza. It's not being distributed because of other issues, but it's not because Israel is trying to starve the Palestinians. This is Israel's point of view. The journalist said that this photograph is misleading because this is not of a young child that was born without other challenges. That yes, this is a child that looks sick and that may also be malnutrition, but is born with a very specific genetic disorder and other issues, and actually showed a health record of that. So to say this is a child that's just suffering from malnutrition is wrong and should be stated. Otherwise, the entire world is seeing the cover of the New York Times thinking this is the way all children look in Gaza, because we don't have access to a lot more photographs and information. So that happened on Monday. We talked about this on Monday. But now in the middle of the week, we actually got a clarification, if you will, from the New York Times. Again, I'm calling it a clarification because of how it is written. Let me go ahead and read it to you. Quote, children in Gaza are malnourished and starving, as New York Times reporters and others have documented. We recently ran a story about Gaza's most vulnerable civilians, including this child, who is about 18 months old and suffers from severe malnutrition. We have since learned new information, including from the hospital that treated him and his medical records, and have updated our story to add context about his pre-existing health problems. This additional detail gives readers a greater understanding of his situation. Our reporters and photographers continue to report from Gaza bravely, sensitively, and at personal risk, so that readers can see firsthand the consequence of the war, a spokesperson for the New York Times. Now, this is true. Anyone that's reporting from Gaza is taking great personal risk. It's a very chaotic situation, and anyone that's able to do any reporting in the area deserves to have respect. This is important here because what they're saying is that their reporting overall isn't wrong, that there's starvation happening and that their reporters are seeing it, but that this the image that they shared with the world actually needs more information. And what they said in this X account from the New York Times communications department is, we have appended an editor's note to a story about this child who was diagnosed with severe malnutrition. After publication, the Times learned that he had also had pre-existing health problems, but they don't specify what it is. The important part about this is not just the clarification and that an impression was given to the entire world about what was happening in Gaza through an image that wasn't entirely accurate. It is true that someone can be suffering from a genetic disorder and also still be starving. So that can, both things can be true. But if you're presenting this as the image on the front cover that is also being shared all over the world, it needs a little extra context to that. The New York Times shared this statement on their New York Times Communication X feed, which has grown in recent days, but is just under 90,000 followers. If I pull up the New York Times, just their general X feed, let me go ahead and do that. It has 55 million followers. And that was for some of the critique that came out, which is, why is this not being announced more visibly and with a bigger audience? So for example, if I had a mistake that I made while I was on television on a news show that I was anchoring, what I would have to do is the next day, or even, you know, if I didn't catch it until later on, or I need to issue some sort of clarification, I would have to get on the air, hopefully around the same time period that I made the mistake, and then announce to the audience my mistake and apologize. And the reason for that is that you want to make sure you get in front of the maximum amount of audience members. You want to make sure that you're actually correcting it in a meaningful way. And it shows that you're taking it seriously. We would never have just made a note on a video on our website, we needed to do it live on television because that was our modality of reporting. You know, on Smarter News, if I make a mistake, I try to clarify it as much as I can in writing or jump back on in front of you and say, hey, I actually made a mistake here and I want to clarify it. So there was some criticism of the New York Times about not making a bigger deal about where they were actually issuing this correction. And that led to more criticism about whether or not they were trying to drive a narrative that was more critical of Israel than what was deserved, because Israel is pushing back on this, saying it's not Israel that's responsible for children not getting aid. It's actually Hamas, the terrorist group that runs Gaza. And so this is the conflict that continues back and forth. But the New York Times has a really big platform and a loud microphone. And so when you have a situation like this, there's no way of getting that front page cover back in the bottle. There's no way of putting the genie back in the bottle. And if that's the image that someone saw that's helping inform their own decision or opinion about the situation, is it meaningful that they get a little bit more information and maybe see some more images? Now, the New York Times had other images of other children. And these children looked that they were suffering. These families definitely look like they're suffering, that they're trying to get food, that they can't get the food, that this is a very extremely trying situation. But facts matter and accuracy is important. And so issuing this clarification and issuing it in a way that doesn't feel completely on center stage just leads to more distrust of the media when you're already in a media environment that's over-reliant on social media, and now no one trusts anybody and no one knows what's actually happening on the ground. And how does anyone have any sort of meaningful conversation when these are the dynamics at play? As a journalist, this is what I struggle with. I'm relying on these huge news organizations that actually still have a bit of a footprint. NPR still has a producer that's in Gaza. I've followed his work for years. The New York Times will find a way to get people in or use some people on the ground. Some of these larger news organizations are able to do that. I'm not able to do that. So I'm really looking at these news organizations, trying to highlight the work that I see or the different patterns of reporting that's happening, almost as using the news organizations to double source each other. And when you have a situation like this, what if I showed you that photo and said, this is what's happening in Gaza, and I missed that context, and I didn't mention what happened with Israel's account putting out some question about this child? Then you would have a completely different impression, and that's my responsibility. So how do we work in this environment? And personally, how do we navigate this as well? You know, if you defend Israel's action in Gaza right now, if that's your point of view, or if you're just curious about what Israel is doing, but you're not overly critical, even if you're just curious, you are instantly criticized for supporting a genocide or wanting to see starving children or being anti-Muslim. You can instantly fall into that category, even just by not asking a super critical question of Israel. Doesn't even mean you have to support Israel. If you flip that, if you stand up for Palestinians in Gaza and you're critical of Israel very loudly, or you're curious about what's going on there and you have questions about what's taking place and you don't like what you see and you're being more verbal about that, then people accuse you of being not only anti-Israel, but maybe even anti-Semitic and supporting a terrorist group at that. So if that's the risk of even asking a question in this story, then why would anyone ask any questions at all? And that's why I wanted to jump in here and add something productive to this conversation. We're not going to be afraid of that. Critique is going to come, but we live in a country where there's a free press and we're allowed to ask some questions. And yes, I'm not on the ground in Gaza, and I have very limited experience in the Middle East. I want you to know all my weaknesses. But in reporting on this story and the story of Israel and Hamas and Gaza and the Palestinians and the West Bank for years, I do think there are some things that are missing from the current media coverage and what you're seeing on social media that I think could actually be helpful to you as you're trying to navigate. How do you actually feel about this? Are we witnessing a genocide and the starvation of an entire generation of children? Are we all standing back and watching that? Are we all culpable in that? Are we supporting a terrorist organization? Is there some sort of narrative or story that we've all lost in all of this? Like, what are we to think about this? And so here are some things that I thought would be helpful. as I see the challenges of this story as well. And I empathize with anyone that's feeling these challenges themselves and wants to know more of the truth. I feel that from you often. You're like, well, what is the truth? And I'm here saying, I don't know right now. And I'm worried. And I've never seen a story like this. It's one of the most challenging stories I've ever seen in my career, where there doesn't seem to be any sort of authoritative voice that is cutting through this. It feels like this story is completely lost to social media, and I've never seen something exactly like this. One of the reasons for this, we'll get to in a moment, I think, is because we're not dealing with two different countries. You know, for example, Russia and Ukraine, I can talk to you about what the Russians are saying, I can talk to you about what the Ukrainians are saying, and then you got a whole lot of other voices. You know, Hamas uses the media in different ways. I don't have a direct line to Hamas as a terrorist organization. And so let's start there. There are three things that I want to leave you with today. One is a reminder, one is a fact, and one is a question. And these are, when I'm looking at my own notes and thinking about my own way to report this, these are some of the things I have to constantly remind myself of or come back to help ground me. So then I feel like whatever news we have to report, there's a new story in the New York Times or something else, that I'm remembering these key components. So here's the first one, a reminder. The reminder is this: Hamas is a terrorist organization. It was designated a foreign terrorist organization before even Al-Qaeda. It's had that designation for decades by the U.S. government. That designation has survived Republican and Democrat administrations and a whole variety of different world events and political points of view. This is a terrorist organization. And oftentimes, when you're reading any story about what's happening in Gaza right now, or what Israel's doing, or what America's doing, oftentimes the voice of Hamas is not represented in these stories. Watch for that. Watch for how many direct quotes you have from Hamas in organizations, because they run Gaza. And because they run Gaza, and because they're a terrorist organization, their priority is not to build a thriving nation state. Their priority is to terrorize, very simply put. So in a normal time, any Palestinians that are living in Gaza are living under the rule of a terrorist group. There's no functioning economy in Gaza in a way that any of us would understand. This is an economy that's completely structured on aid during quote unquote normal times. This question about aid is a question even without conflict. So if we don't remind ourselves that Hamas is the leader of this particular part of the world, then we're missing a key component to this story. You know, some will argue that Israel has a hand in keeping this dynamic in place, is culpable in somehow in the way that Hamas is able to survive and able to continue to run and operate in Gaza. But looking at a part of the world, and that's a fair question to ask, and one that can be debated and can lead to hours and hours of conversation. But if we're looking at this story in front of us right now, just understanding that this is not a typical country. This is not a typical city. This is something different. This is a territory of land that's completely run by a terrorist group. And if it's run by a terrorist group, I want you to think about all the things that you do on a regular basis. Think about who you would call if you got in trouble. I would call the police. What happens if your house is burning down? I would call the fire department here. If you're living in Gaza, who are you calling? If you're trying to be a business leader in Gaza, who are you working with? If I'm a journalist trying to do reporting in Gaza, who do I have to deal with? I have to deal with Hamas. This is part of the reason why you don't have a bunch of Western journalists there. But for some reason, we're not saying that part out loud. We don't talk about that. Like, oh yeah, listen, we've worked and operated in a lot of different places, including, you know, where the Taliban was, where Al-Qaeda was, where ISIS is. But it's so dangerous in Gaza that we actually don't really do that with Hamas. We're very, very limited capabilities. We saw a little bit at the beginning of this recent war, but you don't see it very frequently because everything falls underneath their umbrella. And again, it's sort of like forgotten. So people are talking about, you know, quoting the Gaza Health Ministry, and we keep on saying that and not saying constantly the group, you know, the health group that falls under the leadership of Hamas. It's really important that we remember that. And by the way, Hamas is not denying that. So what I'm saying is not controversial. It's not like taking the side and being like, well, Hamas is actually like a political group and they have really big aspirations and they want to build this wonderful state. No, they are very clear that they're a terrorist group. That's their aspiration. And that's what they want. That's their goal. So we have to be super clear on that. It's totally, I haven't heard any stories this week that have mentioned that very clearly. Why? This is the key part of this story. It's also why negotiations have not been going typically well, why the leverage is different. You're not dealing with a functioning country. You're dealing with a terrorist group that's overseeing a certain territory. So keep that in mind. It's a reminder that we can't forget. This is number two, the fact. This is also something completely lost. Who is the most hurt by Islamic terrorist organizations? Who is the most harmed by Islamic terrorist groups? It's not Israel. It's not Israelis. It's not Americans, despite the terrorist attacks that we've seen on our own soil and in Israel. It's not us. The group of people that's the most terrorized by Islamic terrorist groups like Hamas are other Muslims living in Muslim areas around the world. They are the victims of terror. But again, we don't look at them that way. We forget that the innocent people that are just trying to survive, that were born, just happened to be born in Gaza, just like we happened to be born when we were where we were born. And we would love to say, all of us, I know, that, well, in a situation where suddenly there was a bunch of evildoers around, we would really stand up to them. You know, we wouldn't take it. We'd be very clear that we're open to a relationship with Israel. We would be more, you know, we'd be more outspoken. But that's not dealing with the reality of the ground that every part of your life is tied to a terrorist organization, whether you like it or not. Hamas is completely intertwined with the public. This is part of the reason why the devastation in Gaza is what it is and why there are certain targeting of different buildings that Hamas and others will describe as community centers or civilian areas, because they're totally intertwined with that. This is a key fact. Who is the most terrorized by Islamic terrorist groups? It's other Muslims. And we're seeing that actively in front of us in what's happening in Gaza. Now, there are plenty of questions about whether or not Israel has provided enough aid, whether or not it's getting to where it needs to go, if Israel's impeding that, if Israel is, there's been accusations of Israel firing on civilians unwarranted, breaking human rights and rules of engagement. I mean, there's all sorts of critique happening when it comes to Israel. And I want you to know that's the case. I also want you to know that Israel pushes back on that and says that they're not doing that. So we have two different sides to it. There's also questions about America's involvement. We give aid, we give weapons. We have our presence. We're part of negotiations with Israel when it comes to Hamas in a ceasefire. So what about America's role in all of this? So that leads us to our final question here. So you have a reminder, Hamas is a terrorist group. A fact, Muslims are the most terrorized by Islamic terrorist groups. And here's the question. The question about America's involvement in Israel's role in all this is really important. And I want to recognize that, but I want to take it in a different direction, because all we're seeing is a chewing over of that topic. And you see Democrats and Republicans sometimes on a variety of different sides debating it about what we should do, what we should not do. Fine. I'm actually looking for news, which is the new stuff. And so one question that's never really been answered when it comes to this particular topic is this. Where are the other countries? Okay, so Israel and America can't get a ceasefire done? Cool. Where's everybody else? Okay, these negotiations are happening in Qatar. Qatar provides a safe haven for Hamas, just like they did for the Taliban, to live and go through these negotiations. Okay, there's some questions about Qatar too and their ability to do that. But where's everybody else? Where is everybody else? If the world is as worried as the world says it is about genocide and about what's happening in Gaza, why don't you see a few dozen medical ships parked off the coast of Gaza to help the people? Could it be because there's a concern about Hamas attacking aid that looks like that? But where are the Saudis? Where are the Egyptians? Where are the Jordanians? Where are the Qataris? Where are the Iranians? We know Hamas is a terrorist group that is supported by Iran. So the Iranians are involved. But what's keeping the Iranians from making sure that there's water on the ground in Gaza. Where are they? And you have others. It doesn't have to just be the Middle East. We can ask that same question of European countries. France and the United Kingdom have come out particularly critical of Israel this week, talking about acknowledging a Palestinian state, which is highly controversial in this part of the world. And the United States is not for that. You know, there's all these different shades of this story. But if Europe's so concerned about it, well, where are the French? Where's the French boat? Where are they? They don't want to be on the ground. Oh, they're going to work through the United Nations, right? They might say, well, what there is, but the United Nations, we support the United Nations. The United Nations had to fire some of its employees because there's been questions for years about whether or not certain United Nations employees were working with Hamas because they were operating in Gaza. And in this particular case, the United Nations found that they couldn't completely rule out that some of these employees actually participated in the October 7th terrorist attack. So if you want to say, we're giving it to the UN for support, and that's where we decided to work through these different distribution centers, you know, that's something to consider. But think about how much of the press is focused on Israel and America, but not asking questions of anybody else. And I'm very curious about that. Like, why is that? Why are we not asking these questions of other people too? Are we the only ones, you know? And I think it's the reason I'm feeling that frustration is that I'm feeling a little bit crazy. You know, it's like the same questions that are being asked and asked and asked, and there's no answers coming. And the situation looks terrible, continues to look terrible. And there continues to be negotiations that don't seem to be going anywhere. And you have these hostages that Israel still believes some of them are alive, that they want to get out. But how do you break this face off if there's not new voices? And that's what I'm going to lead you with. I asked that question about other people being involved and bring you back to the fact that it's hard to operate in an area that's run by terrorists. And a lot of people don't want to do it because it's a big risk. But right now, there's no changing to this story. And so that's what I leave you with today is, where are the new ideas? You know, I'm watching today to see if a SpaceX, you know, launch is going to happen. We're going to put a bunch of astronauts back into space. We can do pretty incredible things. So where are the new ideas here? And why aren't we open and pushing for new ideas? And I put the Israelis and Americans in that too. You know, who's benefiting from the same thing happening and the situation getting worse and worse and worse? And how is this leading us to peace? Because that is the ultimate goal for all of us. Again, we go back to the stakes of the story, which is war is not good. We don't want war. We want to live in a peaceful time. So where is there a break in this story that gets us closer to peace and farther away from war? Where are the new ideas? There's a lot of brilliant people in this world. Is it from a lack of good ideas, or is it from a lack of will? Because right now, the story of innocent people being harmed and Israel and America being culpable is a story that's very familiar. And as I mentioned, there's some questions that need to be asked. It's not that it doesn't need to be asked, but what brings us to that next stage? And that's what I'm asking today. So I wish I could tell you, hey, here's the one source I really trust, and here's the one thing that I would keep an eye on. And I don't have that in this story. And I think the fact that I don't have that is important for you to know. It's not from a lack of trying or a lack of a desire. It's because there are parts of this story that are very unique to this part of the world. And I'm doing my best, but it's not good enough here. It's not good enough here. So think about what I mentioned about the New York Times, about the power of images still today, about what you're seeing and what you're feeling, and take that all in. And remember, have your reminder, Hamas is a foreign terrorist organization, a fact. Muslims are disproportionately impacted by Islamic terrorist groups more than any other group. And a question, where are the new ideas? So more on this as we get it. And thank you for your support of Quick, Concise, Nonpartisan, Smarter News, and an occasional reporter's notebook when we need it. All right, guys, have a great day. I'll talk to you later. Bye.